This is Dixie Noonan and Ron Borzakowski with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. We're conducting an interview of Glenn Loney of the Federal Reserve by phone. Hello?
I'm going to conference Glenn and hold on.
Okay.
Well, Glenn, are you there? Okay. Now we have Dixie Noonan and Ron Borzakowski.
Hello?
And I don't know if anybody else.
Nope, that's it. Thank you, Mr. Loney, for taking the time to talk with us today. We certainly appreciate it, and we will try to respect your time and not keep you any longer than absolutely necessary. Basically, at this point, just want to confirm a few things and see if you can give us any additional insights into the investigation that we already are conducting. And I'm sure Dave has told you, and as I believe I mentioned to you on the phone a couple of weeks ago, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission has been tasked by Congress to investigate the causes of the financial crisis. One of the things that we are looking at is the housing market and the role of the subprime market, particularly in the crisis, and are interested in asking you some questions relating to your time at the Federal Reserve and working on specific consumer protection statutes and regulations that that may have been considered by the board during the early late 90s, early 2000s, and going forward time period. I want to let you know that this telephone call is being recorded, and I'll be taking notes as well. So if you have any questions, feel free to ask them, and then we can get started.
Nope.
Okay, great. I believe that Dave has shared with you a few documents.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to read a couple of them, but that's okay.
Okay. Well, we'll start with the one that I gave Dave a little bit earlier that you may have had a chance to at least look at. It's a document dated... Well, actually, I'm sorry. Let me jump back one second. Before we get to specific questions, would you mind just briefly giving us an overview of how long you were at the Federal Reserve and in what capacities you served while you were there?
I joined the board staff on February 24th, 1975. I retired on February 1st, 2010. Started out as a staff attorney and became a section chief of one of the attorney sections in the what used to be called the Office of Consumer Affairs, and then when I first joined, it was called the Office of Saber and Consumer Affairs, then it became the Division of Consumer Affairs, then it became the Division of Consumer and Community Affairs. And I was the section chief for that, for the attorneys doing reg writing. I then took over as manager of the Consumer Compliance Unit in 1979, dealing with exams. I was and complaints. I then became the community affairs officer, as well as the officer in charge of consumer compliance exams. And I was made assistant director in 1980, which is an officer appointment. And then I became associate director, I think, in 1992, and deputy director in 1998, and that's where I retired, deputy director, at which point I had virtually the entire division reporting to me, and I reported to the director, first Dolores Smith, and then to Sandy Bronstein.
Well, it sounds like a long career at the Fed. So congratulations on your retirement, and again, thanks for taking the time so soon after your retirement to talk with us. So I did then want to turn to the document that I was referring to earlier, the dated December 5th, 2000, called The Problem of Predatory Lending.
Mm-hmm.
Had you seen this document while you worked at the Fed? Are you familiar with it?
Oh, I saw it. I mean, that was a long time ago, but yeah, I saw it.
So, So then, okay, and I understand that Jim Michaels authored this. Would you have helped write any of the document or given him anything, advised him in any way in preparing this document?
No.
If you turn, so let's start. If you look at it, to me, this document looks as though it includes some proposals for rulemaking under HOPA. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that's right. I think there was a talking piece.
A committee.
Our oversight committee, you know how the structure was.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
I said, I think it was a talking piece that Jim used in presenting ideas to our oversight committee.
The oversight committee being the members of the Board of Governors who have a subcommittee on consumer affairs?
Yeah, it's actually, I think we called it a committee, but...
Okay. If you look at page 10 of this document, there's a proposal on unaffordable loans.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Do you see that?
Right.
Do you recall this proposal being made to the committee?
Yeah. I mean, I recall that it was.
What was the debate around this particular proposal that would expand HOPA protection to all mortgage loans against engaging in a pattern or practice of making loans solely with respect to the collateral or the equity in the house and not verifying the income that makes the borrower able to pay the loans? Do you recall the debate that occurred around this proposal?
Man, you're talking 10 years ago. I mean, I know that there was debate about whether we should use the pattern of practice language or whether we ought to do a sort of a regulation that would find any particular entity, you know, who make the one mistake in regard to, making a judgment about whether the loans are affordable or not, based on simply, you know, the use of the collateral as the repayment device, and whether there should be simply one circumstance of that, or whether you ought to have at least some sense that this was a practice of the creditor before saying that they had violated the Truth in Lending Act, which is essentially what HOPA is part of. And, there's quite a bit of discussion about what was the right approach. I don't remember who was in favor of what at the time. I mean, I think it was a pretty freewheeling discussion.
Do you remember how that came out? How the committee came out on that?
As I recall, at least the... and my recollection's a little hazy, but my recollection is that the proposal went out as pattern of practice.
So it's your recollection that this proposal was actually included? And the reason I ask is because,
in 2000, it maybe didn't make, in 2008 it did, I believe. And I think in 2008, as I recall, that made it in 2008, ultimately.
Okay.
I don't remember what happened in 2000.
You don't remember what? Okay. So, do you remember? If we kind of step back from the document, when you're thinking about that time period and how the division and the committee were looking at HOPA and looking at how the Board of Governors should use the statutory mandate to regulate against unfair and deceptive practices in the mortgage lending market, was there a debate about using that authority to cover unfair and deceptive practices against all mortgage loans that would be applicable to all mortgage loans? Was there sort of a broader, more general debate along those lines?
In 2000?
Yes. I'm drawing this distinction because HOPA, by its own terms, applies to mortgage refinances, but there's the one provision that tells the board to regulate more broadly against all unfair or deceptive mortgage lending practices, including those that may not be included under the HOPA triggers for the high-cost refinance mortgages.
I don't remember that. I mean, that may have been, but I don't remember.
Okay.
But I think, you know, the thing that we were just talking about, you know, my recollection is better about the 2008, which, where I think the board cited for different high-priced loans, there was to be, you know, the lender was prohibited from making a loan without regard to the borrower's ability to repay, and that it didn't have to be pattern of practice. It was the 2008 one. What happened in 2000 on HOPA loans, I'm a little unclear on. I don't remember exactly how that went.
Okay, that's fine. Did anything come up in the 2008 debates about, or in the 2008 proposals, that people said, oh, we considered this back in 2000, but we didn't do it then, we're going to do it now?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't remember that. I mean, I don't remember somebody saying that.
Okay. If you could look at, I know you said you haven't had much of a chance to look at them, but if you are able to have, do you have in front of you the two documents that Dave sent you today?
Mm-hmm.
So the first one I'm looking at, the first page is an email from Regina Watson dated August 31st, 2000.
Mm-hmm.
And it attaches a memo drafted by you and Dolores Smith on compliance inspections of non-bank subsidiaries of bank holding companies.
Yeah.
And it discusses recommending a pilot program to carry out targeted inspections for predatory lending practices at a limited number of select non-bank subsidiaries.
Mm-hmm.
What was the genesis of this proposal?
The genesis?
Why was... What's the background? What led to this proposal being made?
Well, I mean, that had been an issue for a long time.
What's been an issue?
This issue of what the board ought to be doing with regard to non-bank stuff, holding companies. And so this was just one in a series of, effort to study to the bottom of that. So, I mean, I don't know what prompted that particular one. I mean, people have been raising that issue with us for a long time. And I know, you know, Governor Graham, like, and others were wondering whether we were doing the right thing with regard to that. And, but I don't know what specifically triggered that.
So were you familiar with or involved with the 1998 policy that formalized what the Fed said had been unstated policy all along of not conducting consumer compliance exams of non-bank subsidiaries?
Yep.
Were you involved in formalizing that policy?
Yes.
Why was the decision made to formalize that policy?
Because we had been operating without formal guidance from the board for years and years. And we finally decided that the board did to weigh in on this. If this was the way it wanted to go, then we needed to have the board's promoter on the decision of regarding policy. And so, you know, we had researched the issue for a long time. The Reserve Banks had researched the issue for a long time. And it just seemed that at that point, if we were going to make a decision that we were not going to do this, that we should at least get the board's buy-off on that issue and say, you know, this is what we think is where we are. Are you okay with this, board? Because, you know, there was an awful lot of, heat, perhaps not a lot of light being shed on this viewer during that. So we worked it out and took it to the board. That, of course, didn't end the debate. So, you know, there's more that you've seen.
You said people have been raising this issue for a long time. I mean, who? What types of people were raising this issue?
Well, you know, I think consumer advocates have been raising the issue. Some members of Congress think they've been raising the issue. Whether we ought to be in there sort of looking into non-bank subs and holding companies. And, the question's a natural one, given the fact that we have this responsibility for holding companies. And, there were a lot of complications about it. One was, if you look at the laws we enforce, the specific authority to enforce them against non-banks, such as mortgage subs, finance company subs, or mortgage companies and finance companies that were not subs of holding companies, was given directly to the FTC. We were given the responsibility to enforce truth in lending, equal credit opportunity, things like that, with regard to state member banks and certain foreign banks. And so the question of us sort of stepping into this enforcement role with regard to these entities that were not banks or foreign banking companies raised questions of whether, you know, the Congress had set up an enforcement mechanism, an enforcement approach that, you know, we thought we should be following, and that was we should do state member banks and foreign banks. FTC had its own approach. And various arguments were made about whether it was a good idea for us to get into it or not. For example, if we did mortgage subs of holding companies, we did enforcement through our normal examination approach, then there'd be an unlevel playing field with regard to this mortgage company versus that mortgage company that's not in a holding company, because the FTC didn't do anything of that sort. The issue was raised, well, if we decide, well, we think it's better to do non-bank
subs, mortgage subs or finance company subs through our enforcement mechanism. Aren't we sort of stepping in and, you know, stepping on the prerogative of Congress to decide what kind of enforcement ought to happen to this kind of entity? And in fact, you know, making judgment that money would be spent to do examination work in entities that Congress had assigned to the FTC who didn't do examination work. I think Congress knew quite well that they didn't when they made those decisions about how enforcement would happen. So there were a lot of complications about, you know, sort of how far could we go? Are we just, would we simply be, you know, wasting time and effort because we didn't really have the ability to enforce this stuff fully because Congress had given the enforcement authority to the FTC? People would have thought, well, yeah, the FTC doesn't have the money to do the examination. Well, they could go to Congress and ask for the money. You know, I mean, it's not necessarily the board's place to decide that, you know, our approach to enforcement and examination and enforcement with supervision generally should replace what Congress put in place. So, there was a lot of complications to deciding the answer to that, and those complications got even more muddied when Graham Leach Bliley came along and said that we were to be doing Fed Light. So, you know, if you look at Graham Leach Bliley, it says, it has a provision in it that says that we, can't do enforcement if another entity has been given the authority and responsibility for enforcement. How do we get around all of that, and does it make sense as a matter of law and as a matter of policy to do that?
How did you get around that sort of consideration in 2009 when the policy was reversed?
I'm sorry?
How did you get around that complication in 2009 when the policy was reversed?
Well, I mean, I think that some further legal analysis showed that, well, you know, the Graham Leach Bliley problem, at least with regard to certain laws, could be dealt with. So once we sort of got over that hump, the board decided, and believe me, it was not a comfortable position for us ever for a long time. And the board, they said, well, look, you know, we're just, you know, we're over the hump in terms of the legal issues. I guess the time has come.
What was not a comfortable position? Was it not a comfortable position to not be doing the examinations, or was it not a comfortable position? Okay.
It was not. We were totally comfortable about it. No, I don't. I think a lot of the governors who looked at this and a lot of the staff who looked at this knew that this was going to be something that we were going to hear about for forever, because nobody would stop raising the issue of, well, you can do it, you know, you got the examiners, you've got the examination force, the FTC doesn't, so you should do it. And frankly, you know, the more we got into the holding company oversight on across the board, risk-based oversight generally, the harder it got to say, well, this is a part that we're not going to countenance doing. So once we got over the hump of any legal issues, you know, I think finally the board said, okay, we'll do this oversight piece.
So back to the memo then, sort of the memo about the pilot program, if you had made the decision, you just make the decision in 1998, we've been doing this for a while, we need to get the board sign off, we want to make sure that there's an official word from the board that this is the right way to do it, that's sort of a procedure I would imagine that you go through when you raise something like that with the board. Why then, 2 years later, does it come back up?
Like I said, I don't remember what prompted this in particular. But as I said, you know, this is, it has come up, you know, regularly over time.
Did you ever have direct discussions with Governor Gramlich about this proposal?
Sure.
What were his feelings? What did he tell you about how he thought about this issue?
Well, can you clarify what you mean by this issue?
The issue of the pilot program to examine non-bank subsidiaries in 2000.
Well, I mean, I think in general, Governor Graham might felt the same degree of uncertainty about whether we were doing the right sort of thing. And he understood and had heard the arguments, the legal arguments, the policy arguments, the budget arguments. I mean, he had heard all of that. He'd heard it from the Reserve Bank people. He'd heard it from the staff in the division. He'd heard it from legal division people who had, you know, views on, you know, as I said, the legality issues. So, I mean, I think he was clearly concerned that we were doing the right thing in some, you know, general sense. But what the right thing was not crystal clear because of all those concerns about whether we would be stepping on Congress's toes, whether we were making what essentially amounted to, you know, budget decisions where we were deciding, well, spend our money where Congress chose not to.
So was this memo, it was presented to Governor Gramlich, I presume, since this is who it's directed to. And maybe I could look at the email. There it goes, Edward Gramlich. Was this proposal ever submitted to the board?
No, I don't think so.
Why not?
I don't know. I don't remember why not.
But you're sure that it wasn't?
I'm pretty sure that it wasn't. The only ones I remember going to the board was the 98 letter and then the 2008, you know, proposal. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think there's
So, given your involvement in studying the issue, you wrote this memo and then you wrote a memo in 2002 that was the other document we sent you about supervising bank holding companies for consumer compliance. What did you think about the issue? Did you think that the Fed should be examining these subs?
Me personally?
Yes.
What difference does it make what I think? I was a staffer.
You were advising the board. It's relevant.
Yeah, well, I know. But I, you know, you're asking me my personal opinion.
I'm asking you the opinion that you brought based on your... I'm asking you for your professional opinion based on the research that you did on these issues in your professional capacity at the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, I know. I'm not sure I'm totally comfortable telling you what I think in, you know, beyond what's on the pieces of paper. I mean, you know, that...
Okay, that's That's fair. So then is it fair to say that you made the recommendation, that you stood by the recommendation that's made in the memo?
Well, of course.
To engage the pilot program. This wasn't just a memo that you drafted up at someone's request. This was something that you once you had done the research, you thought this was a good recommendation to make.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't normally do things sort of just off the cuff.
Okay.
I mean, this was a hard issue. And I don't know if what I've just told you made any sense to you or made any impact on you, but it was not a simple issue. I mean, it's something that, frankly, went back to when I first started at the board. People were talking about this issue. People were raising the question of, did we have the responsibility to do the non-bank subs to holding companies in terms of the exams and enforcement? And the issue got raised in a number of quarters over the years, time after time. Issues of our authority, issues of our responsibility got raised. The issue of, well, how come the FTC gets off easy and nobody's busting their chops about not examining these entities that they were given primary responsibility for enforcement for? I mean, why was that? Why did they come to us instead of going to the FTC about it? I mean, if they really wanted exams, they could have gone to the FTC and said, you guys need to examine these folks. You have primary responsibility under the Truth in Lending Act, under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, and a whole plethora of statutes. Why is that nobody did that? Why is it that we should be making a judgment our approach to enforcement was better than their approach to enforcement? Congress didn't seem to think so. They assigned them the responsibility.
So was the 2002 memo... Go ahead. Sorry.
So for people to come to us and say, well, you've got the staff and money, it seems like a pretty simple-minded sort of rejoinder. It doesn't sway me. But from my point of view, I thought it was a complicated issue. And I think what I told you is, demonstrative of that. If it's not, then I guess I'm not speaking English.
So was the 2002 memo about supervising or doing examinations of bank holding companies for consumer compliance, was this just variation on a theme of the same issues you've been already addressing?
A bit of a variation on the theme in that, if you look at sort of what had been happening, our involvement sort of corporately, not just consumer compliance, but the whole of the supervision, safety and soundness supervision generally, had been sort of wrestling with what the right approach to holding company oversight is in the post-Gramm-Leach-Biley era. And we were trying to do a more risk-focused approach to safety and soundness supervision. And the question was, well, if we're going to look at holding companies sort of at the top of the house, make some judgment about where the risks are, and then make a judgment about what we have to do to assess that risk, would it make sense to leave out compliance risk, especially given, all the arguments being made about reputational risk to the entity, to the holding company, if any of subsidiary parts, bank or not, was doing things that, put its reputation on the line. And, that was a very difficult sort of It was kind of a difficult thing to gauge sort of when you had it done properly. And, you know, we were trying to figure out what the Reserve Banks were sort of, okay, you know, we know the board made this thing about this decision about not examining non-bank subs routinely, but is there some aspect of the risk-focused oversight of holding companies that we ought to be involved in? And you know, basically, some of the Reserve Banks, you know, could on themselves to try to formulate an approach that would make some sense where you didn't get into something where you're doing a routine non-bank review, but you're making sure that you are doing some things that would give you a sense of whether there was risk in the holding company that needed to be taken into account in the holding company assessment. And so some of them started doing these efforts that reflect, you know, Cleveland at one point was kind of ahead of the curve on that. But, you know, that was, and having done the sort of review in 2000 that's reflected in that memo, I think Gramlich wanted to know, at some point I may have mentioned to him that, you know, this was going on, and he wanted a report. We decided it was good for our oversight committee, our oversight governor, to have knowledge of what was going on in the system about this issue. So we did that in 2002. Basically, it was just we called up the Reserve Banks, got information about what they were doing, and reported back to Governor Gramlich, maybe the committee, I forget. I guess it was the committee. Anyway, that's all that was. Is that people were, you know, as I said, this issue keeps popping up, sort of what the right stance by the Fed ought to be.
Sure.
And it's not an easy one to figure out what exactly is the right approach. And it wasn't for a long time. And as I said, the thing we did in 2008, I think we just finally hit forward.
So, Glenn, this is Ron. Again, in my head, before the 98 policy, you said that, I mean, this issue had been coming up, so the Fed was not doing any kind of routine exams, but you were routinely getting pressure from outside via Congress or interest groups or consumer groups to start or to think about it or to go somewhere, right? That's
That's
what the world looks like from 75 through 98, and eventually you say, look, we're just not, the policy is a way of just saying, look, we're just not going to do it, stop bothering us. Or put some pressure on the FTC to, like, you know, it's their job. I mean, the statute's explicit under TILA and under ECOA that it's their job.
I know, but as I said, first of all, I don't think I ever said stop bothering them.
Right. I'm sorry.
I was never that impolite to anybody.
I've heard nothing. Your reputation precedes you. I mean, I work with Bob Avery at the board. He says nothing but good things about you.
Yeah, well, he lies. the fact of the matter is that, as I said, this issue came up, back in 1975. And I mean, because we were concerned about whether the board was going to be subject to criticism, political, media, congressional, consumer group, you know, and that we were not thinking about this right, you know, wanted to try to think about it right. I would say it was not a big issue during most of the 80s. I would say, you know, I didn't hear about it much then. But in the 90s, we would hear about it all the time. People would say we should be, you know, doing these non-bank subs. We should be examining them, non-bank subs at holding companies. And it was not, you know, we get it from the Consumer Advisory Council. We get it from consumer groups. We get it from, you know, all over the place. And we wanted to try to make sure that we were in the right place, that we could justify what we did. But at some point, you know, it became uncomfortable for the staff to have made this sort of call and not ever sort of taken it to the board and said, are you sure that's where we want to be? And so that's when we took it to the board in 98.
To your knowledge, go ahead.
No. I think Grant Lee Bliley changed the landscape a bit with Fed Fight and its admonition that we were not to, you know, enforce. And I can't remember exactly how the statute reads, but basically it says we're not to enforce or examine in those cases where another agent's entity has the authority. So that complicated matters some, and it was only after some more sort of legal research and thinking that we came to the conclusion, well, we can possibly get around that if we want to. And so that's when we did the 2008 thing.
So was the 2008 proposal, that was the next time that this issue made its way all the way up to the board?
I believe that's right.
Okay.
That it made it to the board. There have been conversations all along with the committee, even before 98, you know. And I will tell you that a number of governors came in and said, you mean to say we don't look at these? And they couldn't understand why not, you know. And then we tried to explain it to them, and then they say, oh, I see. And but, I mean, there was a level of discomfort about it, I think, all along, or by a number of the governors.
No, I appreciate the context, because it's hard to sort of see to understand the first policy in 98 and the ensuing debate without the sort of long history. This is something that kept coming up. I mean, it was sort of a gap in the regulatory system. It's been pointed out. It's clearly obvious after the crisis. But apparently one that was known and one that people wrestled with.
That's right. As I said, it was not easy, but for some reason, nobody ever took the FTC to task for that. If they wanted that kind of oversight, if they wanted that kind of enforcement, then for the FTC to cry, well, we don't have the money, well, Congress gave you the authority. If Congress wanted them to enforce through an examination process, they could have given them the money for that. But to then say, well, since they won't do that, Fed, you can just sort of do it, seems a bit disingenuous to me. And that was part of the complication of all of this.
Have you ever seen studies about different effectiveness and the repercussions of, you know, an examination procedure like the Fed engaged in versus the sort of, I don't know what the right word is, but responsive enforcement from the FTC, where they'll go in if there are complaints or if there's cause?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think there's any contest, however. I mean, the FTC did very little with regard to this stuff. And they do nothing with regard to complaints. I mean, if you write a complaint to the FTC, you know, it gets put in a file somewhere. It's not investigated, and it's not answered. You know, if you send a Fed complaint, it'll be looked into. And so, I mean, I can imagine, any study coming up saying that FTC approach is better with regard to an individual case. Maybe they do, you know, the occasional big-ticket item enforcement actions. But we're there in these banks, you know, every few years. So, I mean...
And the FTC's got TILA, ACOA, RESPA, all of those, right, for these non-banks?
And all the big... they don't have, for example, CRA.
Right, because...
And I don't know, there probably a couple other ones they don't have, but all the big ones there, the designated enforcement agency for non-banks, and you know, I mean, there's a list. I'm sure you've looked at it.
I've seen the appendix under TILA. To be honest, I haven't looked them up under the others to see if they have the same language.
Well, a number of the other ones are pretty much the same.
Okay.
I mean, they sort of copy it.
With regard to CRA, because you may remember the early years of CRA, was it ever the case that a bank's commitments to make loans, private commitments, let's say community groups, were ever counted as part of the CRA evaluation?
Commitments to community groups?
Yes, and not commitments directly to the Fed. Commitments to third parties, like you know the Acorns of the world or self-help or somebody like that. To make the loans?
I mean, we at the very beginning said we're not going to be in a posture where the Fed's going to be sort of coercing banks into making deals with, you know, community groups so that they can get their applications through. And that was something that the Federal Reserve, a conclusion they came to from the very beginning.
So this is true even in the very early 80s, you know, a few years into CRA?
Oh yeah, late 70s even. But, I mean, any commitment to the board, that's a different deal. If they made a commitment to the board, then, you know, board would expect them to get that commitment.
Were commitments to the board ever the same kind of commitments like the ones that NCRC would tally up and brag about in the press?
No.
Those are just two separate, they don't have the same word, but they're two separate entities, right? Two separate objects.
Yeah, well, the board would, and early on, the board would take commitments to improve their programs, but never, you know, make 25 loans of this type in this neighborhood. We never do that. But even by 1989, the board, in fact, I wrote a policy statement that the board adopted, and then the other agencies adopted, that basically said, you know, it's no longer good enough for you to come to the board and make commitments to get your applications passed. You need to have your act together when you show up, and you can come here and promise all you want to, but that's not going to do good. That's not going to do the job if you haven't had your acts together already.
Is that statement sort of one of these FFIEC public statements? Is there a way you can point me towards that, or
excuse me?
Is that a public document, or is that something I need to?
Oh, absolutely. That was a very famous document, actually.
In 89?
Yeah, 89. I forget exactly when. It's around at the board somewhere. I mean, we did it. The board did it. It was right at the time Continental Bank had a problem. In fact, we denied applications to Continental Bank by Continental Bank. And I think it was right before that or right after that that we put the policy statement out. And basically, the policy system, you know, talked about what we saw as a good CRA program, and also in terms of the application process, said we're not going to take commitments anymore to improve. You've got to have your act together. I mean, it's been, you know, over 10 years since the law went into effect. If you haven't figured it out by now, you know, you're not going to figure it out.
Okay. So if I understand this correctly, the board has never respected commitments to third parties.
And for maybe the first 10 years of CRA, maybe 12 to be precise, they may take commitments between the bank and the board, allow this to go through, and we promise to build a real CRA program or something like that. But that since 89, they would not take those. It's simply a retrospective look at what had you done under the relevant tests over that period.
After 89, no. But, I mean, even before 89, there wasn't a lot of that where they came in and made a commitment to the board. But we would take commitments for improvements, but I can't remember exactly how much of that was going on. But it wasn't like all the time.
Okay.
But, you know, since the 89 policy statement, which we adopted it in a public meeting, and then the other agencies said, well, we want to do it too. And so the other agencies joined up. So it wasn't an FFIEC piece, it was an interagency piece. Because if you recall, the FFIEC includes the NCUA, which is subject to force of CRA. So it's just us and the OCC and the FDIC and the OTS, or yeah, I guess it was OTS then. So, anyway.
No, it's good to know. I'll dig up that document.
It's around somewhere. It was a famous piece of paper, man.
Why do you think banks make these sort of public commitments with third parties if it doesn't get them any CRA credit?
You have to ask them. I mean, certainly the bankers say it keeps them from protesting.
The community groups.
So sometimes he's community groups from protesting, and in fact, had the ironic outcome of, for example, Bank of America. I'm struggling to remember the guy's name. He was described as an urban terrorist. What was it? Bruce Marks.
Yes, Bruce Marks.
And he struck up a deal with Bank of America that did a number on, you know, in terms of his group's ability to bring resources to bear on especially housing matters. And I mean, if you're a low-income person who needs help with getting a mortgage loan, you know, Bruce Marks could do it for you. And that was because Bank of America gave his group a lot of money. Well, Bruce Marks would write in glowing, letters and whenever Bank of America got its wheels in a rut over an application or something, he'd say, oh, well, they're wonderful. So it had the effect of, you know, not only avoiding a protest, but getting very nice letters from, you know, people who were generally antagonistic to the bank's interests. You'd have to ask, but I mean, the individual bankers will motivate them in a particular case, but certainly we heard, you know, bankers say, well, I do it because I don't want to protest. Protest is too much, it's too, take too much time, especially big banks, where, you know, we occasionally, if things were off the rails, apparently, or we wanted to know if they were off the rails, we'd hold hearings. Well, hearings take up a lot of time, and, you know, they're public and can get you some bad press if you're a bank. They just as soon avoid that. But, you know, you'd have to ask the individual bankers why, in a particular case, they did what they did.
Of course.
Sometimes, frankly, they were just good business. You know, there is good business out there in low-income communities.
Well, Mr. Loney, I don't think we have any more questions at this time. I really appreciate your sharing all this with us. It certainly makes our job a little bit easier to get a little bit of the context of what was going on at the time, especially around the CRA and the examination of the non-bank subs. We really appreciate it.
All right.
All right. Well, We will let you go. Dave, thanks again for setting this up and for getting
all right, no problem.
The documents.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care, gentlemen.
Bye.
End tape.